That was probably the most valuable skill I learned from banking, my Excel skills, because I still use it today, not to build financial models, but like I know how to interpret data, and I could use it just for daily things that most people wouldn't think to use for, because people don't use Excel day in and day out. And yeah, I took a 400% pay cut and then just started off entry level.
You took a what pay cut? My goodness.
The SDR job is one of the hardest jobs on the planet, honestly. Like, yeah. Even though investment banking was demanding, SDRs are, it's a grind.
You gotta be resilient.
You gotta be resilient, and you gotta to figure it out.
How would you define
it? I'm more focused on the go-to-market side. So I work very closely with the product and R&D team, but I'm essentially kind of looking over everything that touches email from a go-to-market perspective. So partner, CS, sales, account management, and then working with every single go-to-market leader across departments and globally to ensure that, like, my goal is...
Are you interested in working in the tech industry? Do you sometimes wonder if you've got what it takes to progress? Guys, make sure to tune into this episode with Robin Lee. She's the general manager at e-commerce juggernaut Yotpo. We talk about a whole host of things. It is going to be one that you don't want to miss. So many gems were shared in this episode. And guys, if you like what you listen to, you know what you need to do. Like, subscribe, share, comment. It does wonders for the channel. Thank you. Now back to the show. Hi guys, welcome to another episode of What My Best Friend Does, where we talk about what your best friends do so you don't have to. Today, I'm joined by my best friend, the general manager, Robin. How you doing?
Good, how are you? Thank you so much for having me.
I'm doing very well. Welcome to the show. I was just saying, I think you're the first international guest we've had. So come on.
Let's go.
This is
first
amazing.
American.
First American, all the way over from sunny New York, if I can
I
say
came just
that.
For this, actually. Yeah,
exactly. And we really appreciate you coming on. We like to start with a little icebreaker. What did you want to be growing up?
So when I was growing up, I wanted to be a teacher.
Oh.
Honestly, I only wanted to be the teacher because I really liked whiteboards and chalkboards and the projectors. I don't know if you guys were young enough back then, but or old enough, or I'm old now, I guess. But we used to have these like projector screens and I loved the markers that you would have to draw on it.
Yeah.
So I think I stopped wanting to be a teacher after like third grade because we stopped, I didn't care as much. And then we went into middle school, but initially a teacher. And then after that, I didn't really have a particular career that I wanted to.
Okay. So, all right. So you wanted to be a teacher when you were younger and then...
Like very young.
Okay. Yeah. Very, third grade. And then you weren't too sure after that. Can you talk me through kind of your journey to this point? So did you go to, you call it college, right?
Mm-hmm.
What did you study at college?
The American Way College, yes. So I went to GW, which is a school in Washington, D.C., and I studied finance,
Okay. Which
was very boring. But I was in the finance school, and from there, there was actually a couple banks that had come down my junior year. So this is typically when financial firms are coming down. You can interview for a summer internship. So I got the summer analyst position at UBS, which is an investment bank. So I was there by summer between junior and senior year. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, you do the summer analyst program so that you can get a potential full-time offer. I was given the full-time offer. So after college, I just went straight to New York and started my life in investment banking.
Oh, wow. So kind of, I think from what you've said there, your next step was kind of decided for you, right? It was kind of just like the logical next thing for you to do.
Yeah. Like I basically got the summer analyst after the summer analyst program, got the full-time offer, and that's right before senior year of college, mind you. So that's like a huge relief because you're in college, you're partying, you're having fun, it's your last year of college, and then you have the final job secured. So I just went straight into New York after college and did that for 4 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you did investment banking. So can like for the listener, how would you describe investment banking and the finance industry?
Yeah. So the first group that I was in was equity capital markets. So there's equity capital markets, debt capital markets, and then there's the coverage groups, which are split up by industry. My specific group at the time was focused on any sort of public equity offering. So if companies are going public, if companies are doing a secondary offering, We were responsible for like pitching to clients and trying to get their business as one of the banks to eventually, as an example, take Yapo public or mm-hmm. take another company public. So that was my first 3 years. And then the last year I actually moved to the consumer products and retail group. So in the consumer products and retail group, you cover that full industry, but you're not just doing equity offerings. You're also covering debt or M&A. It's exactly what it sounds like, full coverage. So covering that industry, but doing more than just equity. Okay. So more than just IPOs or secondary offerings.
Do you feel like what you studied in college prepared you for those 4 years?
That is a great question. And no, I do not think so at all.
Okay.
I went to like accounting classes, and I guess I learned like, I don't know. I took weird classes because I was trying to get like art history of Japan or some random stuff. But even though my major was finance, like until you're in a role like that and you're just forced to learn how to build out financial models, you know, it's cool not to touch your mouse because you're only on your keyboard and like building these pitch decks, like nothing can really prepare you for that unless mm-hmm. you just actually start doing it. Maybe mm-hmm. college is different now, but I can tell you it didn't.
And for people who, you know, they might be listening to this, I know we're going to get into what you do now, but yeah, you know, maybe they're thinking about going into finance. What are kind of the skills of people who typically do well, or people you saw do well in the finance industry?
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible experience, but it's a grind for sure. And I think skills, so people who, I guess, like numbers, people who are usually math oriented, I would say, is good for the specific analyst and associate role where you're grinding
out. Good at Excel and spreadsheets.
Good at Excel, good at spreadsheets. Honestly, that was probably the most valuable skill I learned from banking, my Excel skills, because I still use it today, not to build full-blown financial models, but like I know how to interpret data, and I could use it just for daily things that most people wouldn't think to use for, because mm-hmm. people don't use Excel day in and day out. But also attention to detail. Like you're really, when we're creating pitch decks, you're forced to left align and coloring and format and language. So it's a grind. I learned a lot. I learned a lot about business. It was not for me in the long term. So I think the people that are good at it, like they're very detail oriented, thorough. They can work very hard. And again, math, I guess.
And then the final thing I'll say just before we move on, like you obviously secured your place while studying. Do you need to go to college in order to get a banking job like that? Or like in the UK, there are like internships and things like that that can get you on the career ladder. Mm-hmm. Is there the equivalent in the US, or you kind of have to go to college to give yourself the best chance?
Sadly, I think you probably have to go to college, but not necessarily. So my brother, he was a software engineer, and he studied computer science in college, and he actually went to Bridgewater, which is, you know, one of the largest hedge funds in the world, after college. I don't actually remember if he did a summer analyst program, but he majored in something totally different. He didn't go through like a summer analyst program or anything like that.
But he still
went to college,
brilliant
guy,
though, right?
But he did go to college. Exactly. Yes. Yeah. So I think it's like an American standard that you do. But I wouldn't say it's always the case. Interestingly, there's another level above that where people will, after college, they'll go to like grad school. And so people who are a bit older will actually come in through like an analyst program, but for associates. So they'll come in at a higher level.
Yeah.
So then that's really interesting because they actually are a bit older than the analyst class, but they don't have as much experience in the weeds because they're in the, they're coming from grad school.
Yeah.
So similar to like when I come from college and I didn't have any, you know, relevant skills from my finance classes. For investment banking specifically, I want to say that most of them do come from college. I can't think of a single bank that is hired from that hasn't gone to college.
Okay. Well, you
do
can
I agree
let us
with
know.
It? I don't know.
Yeah. People can let us know if there are exceptions to the rule. But yeah, you mentioned you did that for 4 years. You said it wasn't for you. So yeah, talk me through your next step and yeah, what led you to kind of transitioning into e-commerce?
So definitely wasn't a choice to go to e-commerce specifically,
okay.
But I just wanted to get into tech because it sounded cool at the time. It was 4 years. I was honestly like super burnt out. I just kind of looked around and, you know, there's a lot of, some of my best friends are still at the companies or in banking or in finance. And I just looked around and I was like, look, I'm not as good as this as you guys are.
Yeah.
It's not also super interesting to me. And I can't see myself climbing up the ranks and becoming an MD of a investment bank one day. So I kind of was like, all right, I'm 27. I feel like if I need to move and do something, like maybe I should start now. And so I actually got a referral from my friend at the time who had another friend who worked at Yapo. And then I interviewed at another company. And then I just took two interviews and I interviewed for the SDR role, which was an entry level role.
Yeah.
I was a bit rash in my interviewing. I think I probably could have interviewed other places and gotten more money or like started as an AE or something, but I kind of just went for it. I was like, whatever.
Yeah.
Chose Yapo. Honestly, it was the hiring managers at the time that made me compelled to go there instead of the other company. And yeah, I took a 400% pay cut and then just started off entry level.
You took a what pay cut? My goodness. And like, you know, people listening to this, you know, thinking, it sounds like it's never too late, number one, to just start again from the ground up. And what was it about kind of, was it the pain, I suppose, of your existing situation that made taking the pay cut all right?
So within, at least in investment banking, like every year you get your annual bonus. And so I left right
after okay, I got my smart. Fourth bonus. Okay.
Because otherwise the longer you stay, then you're like, oh man, should I stay another year? And so at that point too, I was pretty financially secure. So I think I was able to take
the risk
yeah. and go to, and just take a big pay cut cause I had, you know, money saved up. But it was also, but I never regretted going. So I started as an SDR.
Yeah.
So I went from, you know, working with really large companies at a really large bank to cold calling people and selling them Yapo reviews to e-com stores. And this is back when, again, like e-com wasn't even, it was still kind of picking up and taking off, but I didn't even know what Yapo did, to be honest.
So you just learned everything on the job.
Pretty much. I learned how to, we were making, this is back when, you know, outbound sales was a bit different back in the day, like 90 dials, like, and I was just cold calling. And actually I was pretty good at cold calling and I respect people that still cold call me. Like I'll give them advice sometimes. I went from really intensive work to like pretty 9 to 6 where you're building pipeline, just cold calling. And the SDR job is one of the hardest jobs on the planet, honestly. Like even though investment banking was demanding, SDRs are, it's a grind.
You've got to be resilient.
You got to be resilient and you got to figure it out.
Yeah, you
and
do.
There's no secret sauce. So
one thing I will say to the listener is that for anybody who is looking to get into tech and leave an industry or might be starting their career, 9 times out of 10, you're going to start in the SDR role. It is typically like the entry level requirement just to make sure like you're a good fit. Right, because people see the glamorous roles in customer success or AE or sales and they think, oh yeah, I can do that. But you have to kind of cut your teeth as an SDR, prove that you can put in the hours, source those leads, be resourceful before you get the relevant, before you can take the relevant next step.
Right? Yeah, to be honest, I only interviewed at two companies, but I'm so happy I did the SDR role. Like, I don't think I would have been as good of an account executive, especially not coming from another tech company without the SDR experience. So kudos to all the SDRs out there. I have a lot of respect. It's a very hard job. But you also kind of figure out like, okay, do I even want an account executive role? Like sometimes we've had many SDRs that have also gone to CS paths or
that's
partners.
What I did.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it makes you realize what you do or don't like. And I think for sales, like you either like sales or you don't.
100%.
And I think it's a great opportunity to get your feet wet and just kind of explore. But ultimately my goal was to get to an AE.
Okay, amazing. And just before we talk about the AE role, what would you say what were the biggest things you learned being an SDR?
I think you just have to figure out like your own way of doing things. Like every SDR was very different in their style. Like some would go for more of the wider approach, you know, volume play. They would constantly be prospecting. Other SDRs would be more personalized, smaller, but like more thoughtful outreach. The best advice for SDR though, it's like, you just kind of got to try new things. Like there is no real playbook, like, and it's constantly changing. Mm. And so you just got to figure it out. And I think it really helps to be with other SDRs and have friends, because again, if you're cold calling or cold emailing, like it can be fun if you can support one another, 100%. Even when you get a bad email response 100%. Or someone hanging up on you, like you need someone to not feel so alone in that job.
I think in my previous company, when I was doing SDR, we'd do like power hours.
Yes.
So it'd be like everyone huddle up, blast as many calls as you can, blast as many emails as you can. And let's see who can book the most meetings in the next hour. So yeah, I definitely agree on doing it together. It makes it easier. But yeah, that takes us nicely into, you said you wanted to be an AE. So you transitioned from SDR to AE. Yeah, talk me through that.
Yeah, so then eventually got to AE, and again, the SDR experience was really helpful because I knew how to build pipeline, and for an AE, like, you could be getting it from multiple different sources, whether it's inbound or partners or outbounding yourself. Honestly, the best AEs at the company have been the ones that have been SDRs before because they are able to generate pipeline. Mm. So at the time when I was an AE, I guess we had reviews and loyalty at the time. And so I was selling that, and it was great because I got closing experience. And it was really nice because, again, I think the best AEs were the ones that can supplement their pipeline with demand. So, like, having that SDR experience was really helpful. I got to get deeper within the actual product. I got to learn how to negotiate. So being an AE was – and then, frankly, I was an AE for, I think, like 8 or 9 months. And then they were like, we actually think you might be good as a manager.
Amazing.
Which was unexpected. And I wasn't planning to be in a management role, but then it just kind of...
It kind of happened.
It kind of happened. And I had myself thinking, I was like, actually, yeah, like, I don't also see myself as a lifetime AE either. So yeah.
How did you find management and managing people and the transition?
Yeah. So... interesting, because I went from being an individual contributor to then a manager, and I was managing at first some SDRs and an AE. So it was a bit strange because I was their peer and now I was their manager. But then we had a lot of newer folks come in. And so I think for the SDR role, it was I was managing mostly SDRs at first. It was a pretty natural transition, I guess, because I felt very close to the team, and it was more of like a rah-rah and like building some processes and playbooks.
Can I just, you mentioned the fact that, yeah, it was a little bit strange because you were their peer and then you become their manager. I think this is something that actually happens quite regularly but isn't spoken about. It can be quite a fragile thing, right? Because... you still want to be friends, but you have to be professional and you have to be their manager. Mm-hmm. What, for anybody who's potentially going through something similar, what would your key piece of advice be for them to make sure you don't lose the friendship, but then you can still do your job as the manager?
It's very hard.
Yeah. or do you have to pick, like, ultimately?
Well, that's the thing. Like, if you're an authentic person, you know, even if you're in a different role, I guess the dynamic of the relationship changes, but... at the end of the day, if you're transparent about it, like, when I've done this before, and also when I progressed past the first manager role and I was managing mostly AEs, a lot of them, again, were more my peers that I was then managing. And I think it's just about addressing it straight up front. Like, yeah. I was still very much myself. I just told them, I was like, hey, I know this is kind of weird, but I'm taking on this management role. Like, your interests are in my best interests, and I want to make sure you succeed. And it's funny because now when I progressed onto eventually the account management side, like, I promoted one of the people on my team that was an AE into the management role. So he actually had the same position challenge of managing peers.
Yeah, exactly.
Again, but it's hard. Like, I think it's not that you have to not be friends or not be a manager, choose one or the other. I think you just have to be very honest. Mm. I think with people management in particular, like, this is why, especially for sales, like, you have goals in place. And if you're not hitting those goals and you're explaining and you're trying to work towards, you know, a path to hit those goals, if you're transparent about it, like, it shouldn't be a surprise when things go wrong. And, like, you need to be able to have tangible milestones or examples of, like, hey, if you're not doing XYZ, like, this isn't working, we need to improve this. Mm-hmm. But I think that's just people management in general. It's not even so much the peer management, it's actually people management. And in some ways, I do think it's helped because the managers really have empathy of what it's like to be a seller.
Yeah. Okay, that's great. So what I've taken away from that is, if you have peers and maybe you're elevated above them, just be open and honest with them and transparent, because ultimately their goals are your goals and you're both striving to to do the same thing.
And yeah, pretty much. But also, it's like different strengths, you know, like some AE, like, there's AEs that are better AEs than I was, you know, and like management, I think, was a more natural path for me. And so just leaning into your strengths and being open and honest about that, being like, hey, I'm trying to get into management. Like, ultimately, I want to help you, but, you know, I'm not trying to be an AE for life, and you want to be an AE, like, it's, yeah, it's different roles.
Yeah, 100%. On that, I've asked some previous managers who've been on the podcast, how would you say the role of manager varies from being an individual contributor? What would you say are, like, the glaring differences?
I mean, there's a lot.
What comes to your mind first, as I've said that?
Between an IC role, yeah, and a manager role, you don't own your calendar. Okay. You're at the beck and call of your team. And so, whereas in AE, you have full flexibility. You schedule your calls, you can organize everything. I think you just don't own your calendar anymore. Like, your life is dictated by the people that you're managing.
It's so true. Yeah. It's so true.
And I feel like I'm somewhat of an empath. And so if people are you carry a lot of the stress and anxiety of the team because it's your job to, you know, help them through it. I don't know. Maybe that's just me and I'm just emotional.
No, it's good. It's good. It's good being an empath.
But yeah, I mean, it's a different mindset. Like, you have to be able to rally the team together, push them, encourage them. I think I was very much a manager where, like, I would like to share learnings and do things together. There's different types of management styles. But from an IC to a manager, it's, yeah, you just don't own your calendar.
Okay, that's like...
And you have to be okay with that.
Yeah. And, alongside that, what are some of, like, the key skills that are needed to be a manager? I know different styles can vary, but what are the skills that you've seen amongst the best managers that you've either worked with, worked for?
My manager at the time when I was an SDR and was the one who promoted me to the AE position, then managed me as an AE and then to a manager role, he was just such a good people manager. He was so good at diagnosing what the problem was, and he was himself a very good seller. I will say, for you to be a good, in my personal opinion, for you to be a good sales manager, like, you really have had to have a sales role before, like an AE role before, where you've actually closed. I've seen that happen where it doesn't, and maybe I'm wrong, but, like, every time I've seen this happen where we haven't had managers that have actually closed business before, like, it's very hard to, it's hard. And it's also very different based on the department. So, like, sales versus CS, like, I've seen different strengths, but I would say for managers, like, one, there just has to be a process. Like, you can't hold people accountable if you're, like, not, you can't just be like, oh, that wasn't good or that wasn't bad. Like, it's good to have, like, consistent call reviews or, like, some sort of process and rhythm to hold, to make it unbiased, yeah. I would say. Yeah. And also, like, leading through encouragement and, like, sharing other wins. Like, I think there's other examples. Like, I don't think it's great to tell someone, you know, hey, like, that call sucked. Like, you should do XYZ better. But, like, it's much more powerful when you can point to something else that someone else did on the team really, really well. And they share it with the team and it kind of creates a FOMO effect where the other sellers are like, oh man, like, you know, she's crushing goal. I want to start adopting some of these talk tracks and outbounding skills, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think just honest managers, like, yeah. I just don't think they can beat around the bush. Like, this is, sales is cutthroat. You have goals to hit. If you don't hit them, like, I think the worst thing a sales manager can do is drag someone along and when it's not working out.
Yeah, 100%. Can I just say, like, I'm at a stage in my career where I'm looking at the next step and I feel like I'm getting firsthand insight into like the considerations for management, and I'm loving it. So thank you so
much.
You're
like, I love giving up my calendar.
Yeah, I'm like, damn, am I ready to give up my calendar? Like, that one hit me deep. I'm like, I don't know. But yeah, so sorry, going back to the roles, right? So we spoke about you managing the SDRs, and then you said you moved into managing the AEs, is it?
Yep. And then, yeah, managing AEs. So that was for about 2 years.
Okay.
And then after that, I moved over to lead our account management team.
Okay.
So our account management team was newer at the time, and it's basically sales, but post-sales to existing customers.
Okay.
So if you think about the history of Yapo, when we only had reviews, like, an account management team wasn't really necessary, but then we had loyalty and then we had SMS, and so we have a bigger install base to actually sell. So account management was really fun because I got a lot more exposure to, it was still sales, but a lot more exposure to the CS side.
Yeah. Okay. Amazing. And, you know, you've mentioned the fact that there wasn't need for the account management team and then there became a need. Is there big differences between account management and, like, traditional sales?
It really depends on the business. So, I mean, usually sales is sales. But account management sometimes at some other businesses is more retention focused. So like the way that our AM and CS teams are structured, like AMs still have goals just like CSMs do, versus at some companies they're actually maybe have more of a net retention type number and they're more accountable for renewals and expansions and upsells. But obviously at Yapo, you know, the CSMs are typically responsible for that, but they do work together a lot with the AM. So just depending on the org, the AM function can be a little bit different.
Okay. Okay. Great. And then, so how long did you do that role for? So managing the AMs?
The AMs were for 2 years.
Okay. Wow. Yes. So a lot of management. And then from there, does that bring up, you've got a new role now, don't you? Where you're the general manager of like specific products within the Yotpo platform, correct?
Correct.
Okay, amazing. And can you talk a little bit about like a general manager role? Because I've seen them about, and obviously at Yotpo we have a few general managers, but yeah, it'd be great to, how would you define a general manager?
Yeah, so for me, and our newer so our more mature products, our GMs are more product-led oriented or product-oriented GMs. Because they're mature. We've had them for a long time, and it's about making sure that there's a really close feedback loop between go-to-market and product to keep innovating. But for our newer products, so like email and subs and SMS, I'm more focused on the go-to-market side. So I work very closely with the product and R&D teams over in Tel Aviv and Sofia, but I'm essentially kind of looking over everything that touches email from a go-to-market perspective. So partner, CS, sales, account management, and then working with every single go-to-market leader across departments and globally to ensure that, like, my goal is my email goal. So that's my number. Mm-hmm. And the reason why we changed to the GM model was also because we realized that we need distinct owners by product line to ensure that each product line also advances and progresses in addition to the entire platform. Mm-hmm. So yeah, email is my baby, I guess that's my number, but there's a full army of people behind it.
Yeah, amazing. And I think, you know, it's been great to hear your journey, because you've been at Yotpo for what, over 7 years, maybe even 8 years. You've grown with the business. The business now has, you know, almost 1,000 people across so many regions. I suppose my question there is, have you had mentors? How is it you've navigated, I suppose, over the years and got all of this knowledge?
Not like official mentors, but I consider many people that I've worked for and with mentors. So, you know, Naps, who was my first manager at the time when I came into the AE role, a management role at Yapo, so many people that I've reported to, like, they've become just mentors of mine. And also, I would say other people at other departments that I've become close friends with that have really good perspective into the business. So I wouldn't say I've had a formal mentor, but they've so many friends, close friends that have now become, like, again, very valuable and insightful people to me.
So this might sound like a silly question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. As you say that, like, how is it that you make friendships? Because there might be people who, you know, they're a bit timid. Like, is it you're putting time in people's calendars? Is it like the socials that are held? Like, you just end up speaking to people at drinks? Like, how is it you've gone about building that internal network of friends?
Well, I guess it kind of has to happen if you've been here for so long. I will say when I first joined, it was a very different culture at the company. Like, it was, you know, it was a much, we were much younger and, you know, we were having a lot of fun. But how do I develop those friendships? This sounds like bad, like I'm complaining, but I'm not. Like, honestly, like, you commiserate together in many ways, but you also, there's good things to celebrate too. But, you know, some of my counterparts in other departments, I'll, like, we bond by, again, this sounds weird, but like by complaining or like, I'm like, oh man, like that sucks. Like, did you hear about this? And they're like, oh yeah. And, you know, that's one example, but I feel like that's how normal friendships are also made, you know, 100%. And that makes it sound like I'm complaining, which I'm not, but I do, but
I think it's healthy to complain.
And I'm like, okay, I'm human, you know, there's going to be some down times, and then it kind of becomes a natural, like a, not, again, this sounds so negative, a shoulder to cry on, but like you have your go-to person where you feel like you can trust them and, you know, get their perspective and also get their feedback. It's like, hey, am I overreacting to this or is this normal?
Yeah.
And I think that's the most organic
way. Yeah, no, fair. Because I think sometimes, and, you know, I know for the listener, like we said, it's such a big company, right? And I think some people, you know, they have their roles and I think they feel like, you know, getting to a manager is unattainable, or VP is unattainable, or GM is unattainable, but it's not. And I think, yeah, just by putting yourself out there. Also, I think one thing that's been great at Yotpo, when people are traveling between offices, you know, the fact that you're in London at the moment, I think just taking time to speak to people, it goes a long way. I mean, Robin doesn't know it yet, but we're now friends for life.
Exactly.
We're besties. So whenever I'm in New York, I'm sure I'm going to, you know, message and we're going to meet up. But I think, you know, the reason for this part of the conversation is to be like, when you're at work, be sure to reach out to people, because those people, whether it be good or whether it be bad, they're gonna be there for you at pivotal points in your journey.
I remember when I was like an SDR, and I totally agree with what you said, by the way, like I think it's so important to also get out of your own team and your group. Like I remember when I was an SDR, I would talk to the CSMs and I would talk to the sales engineers, and I was just very, I think I was very curious to just develop friendships and understand other departments. But as the career, the different chapters of my career progressed, a lot of leadership decisions and like who is going to move between different departments is based on, you know, how other people perceive you from 100%. Other departments. So if you're going to move cross-functionally to a different group, or even just up the chain, usually people are always thinking, well, how do people think about this person, or how have people's experience has been with that person? So it's so important to get out of like your own team and understand how the other functions operate.
Yeah.
Really important, I think, for tech, especially because there's so many different roles that you can go to.
Yeah. And the last thing on this, and I know we've spoken about it a lot, is I've said it on a couple of previous episodes, you have to network sideways. And the reason you network sideways is because you might be at one rung, but I'm sure in management, as some people get promoted, like you said, they're going to be the people who they're asking for opinions when they're trying to bring you up the ladder. And so long you've made that right impression, people can help to push you along at those right times.
Network sideways, that's a good way to put it.
When I heard
that,
did
you coin that term?
Yeah, no, I didn't. It was Mark, who's the previous guest on this this podcast. So shout out Mark. But okay, so you're the general manager. You've held so many different roles. What has been the most difficult thing to do in all of the roles, would you say? And I know that's such a general question.
The most difficult thing to do.
Or let's say, what has been the most difficult role, would you say?
Probably this one. Because, it's just it's a newer role. So I think we're all trying to figure it out, even just as a company. And there's a lot of different departments. And I mean, it's been the most exciting role for sure. But I think it's also been the most difficult, which I guess inherently it's supposed to be, right? Yeah. Like it's supposed to be another challenge. I think it's challenging because there's a lot of people and a lot of departments that I have to liaise with, but I don't actually directly manage anyone in this model. So it requires a lot of finessing and collaboration across different teams. And again, it's our newest product, pressure, you know, I still have a number to hit.
Yeah.
But I love that I've gotten to work closely with product and R&D and get a lot more familiar with partners, like other departments that I just normally wasn't as close to before. But yeah, it's tough. There's a lot of people touching email.
No, I hear that. And you know, you can tell me, because the role is so new and it's a new product, do you find yourself defining the process and kind of like how to be successful in your role?
Kind of. And I already know the areas that I'm somewhat failing in, because I'm feeling very chaotic and disorganized. And I know that it's really needs to come back to me just more clearly defining the strategy. And I think it's partially also defining roles and responsibilities, again, because I'm not directly managing anyone. When I'm working with these go-to-market leaders, a lot of cooks in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And it gets very chaotic. But I think I sometimes get paralyzed, and I can't you know, either properly delegate or just kind of zoom out. And I think I need to rely more on my peers and my leaders around me. So yeah, it's been hard, but I definitely, I can't remember your original question.
I don't remember it either. No, I was going to say, what were we saying? Yeah. So basically you're defining, you defining like your role because it's so new?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I don't think even, well, I know what means success, which is we, you know, grow the email product. But yeah, I don't think, because we haven't had it, I don't know if there's like a...
There's not like a playbook, like
a,
right?
Yeah, there's not a playbook.
Everything that's happening right now, no. You're kind of forging the path. And the reason I say that is because, especially in tech companies, as companies expand, it's those people who have like the go-getter mindset who are kind of thrust into the unknown, I suppose, to go and get it. And I suppose I just wanted to kind of understand from you, like, yeah, like when you have to go and get something, what the mindset is, right? Like just hearing you say that, you know, you feel like you're failing and you need to trust, it's like so honest. And I think I'm just trying to, yeah, shine a light on what going into the unknown is like, I suppose.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. I mean, I feel very busy, and I feel like, you know, when you're really in it though, when all you think about, like all I think about is email, for better or worse. Like I wake up thinking about integrations, or I wake up thinking about partners. It's like very integrated in my life right now. But it's really fun if you can just kind of take a step back and organize yourself, and then you're like, sometimes I'll have so many different tasks coming at me, but if I ignore them for just even like a day and I really just think about it, I'm able to be like, okay, this is actually what I'm trying to do. And sometimes my plans completely change. The volume of emails I receive now, like the amount of inquiries and requests coming towards me is a lot. And I think you really have to be able to block out the noise. Like I used to respond and read to everything. I think it's very hard to do that right now. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because some things just actually solve for themselves. I will say a big thing, especially in a role like this, is like you just kind of have to fail sometimes in order to actually get people to rally around it and fix it. I want, like, I'm notoriously, I like control, and I want to be able to make sure nothing goes wrong. But there's been instances where things have gone wrong, and frankly, like, it needed to happen for us to realize, okay, we have a problem. So it's not always going to be perfectly preventable all the time.
In that situation where something goes wrong, what happens? Not in, you don't need to tell me what goes wrong, but how do you rebound from that, or how do you rectify and learn?
Yeah, I guess it depends on the situation, but it's never about like shaming anyone, you know, like no one, it's never a single person's fault. Like if something goes wrong, if whether it's with a client or I don't know, something else I can't think of, but it's usually just trying to understand like why it went wrong in the first place. So what was the issue? Was it a product issue? Was it like a responsiveness issue? Was it a lack of data problem? And then you just figure it out. Then it's not really that big of a deal at the end of the day. You fix it and you move on. I think being able to bounce back and just understand why it happened, fix it, like, it's what we're doing every single day.
100%. And you mentioned the fact that you're getting pinged from everywhere. Like, how do you prioritize? So I've heard people use the term, I think I actually heard you use the term ruthless prioritization. Talk to me about how you go about that.
So funny enough, I'm actually very bad at prioritization.
Okay.
I like to say the words because it sounds sophisticated, yeah. And fancy, but no. Like for product roadmap planning, that's what we were talking about. It's really about ruthless prioritization. You have to choose. I am actually awful at prioritization, but I think it's because I have a lot of work that I just need to catch up on. And I'm just feeling very disorganized. But honestly, like, it is weird. I used to literally respond to everything, read everything. And sometimes I just don't respond right away. And I actually have found that in many cases it works better because either one, they figure it out, or two, I have a moment to think about it, or I see other people's reactions. I've just gotten to realize you don't need to respond in 2 seconds.
Not at all.
And it's actually probably better that you don't in many ways.
100%. So something I was always taught, and I do this in my role as a CSM, if you respond to everything after 2 seconds, people are always going to expect you to respond after 2 seconds. You have to just give yourself like that buffer because it's just real life, right?
Yeah.
So you shouldn't set that unrealistic expectations.
I will say, like, again, I don't really own my calendar still, but actually it's funny. I do own my calendar. My calendar doesn't feel owned. I find it really challenging to be able to bounce between like client calls, internal meetings, other sessions. So not that I'm doing this right now, but I find I'm a lot more productive when I have blocks where it's just like heads down, do work, grind through emails, and then another block, then other blocks for calls, but in reality, it just doesn't work out that way all the time.
Always the way. Yeah.
It doesn't work. But apparently, I want to try this app, Superhuman.
For emails.
Yeah, apparently. It's amazing. I haven't downloaded it yet, but
Tom shouted that out on this podcast.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he did. So make sure you check it out. Yeah. And Superhuman, you want some sponsorship? Yeah, exactly. You know what I mean? But talking about productivity, right? So you've mentioned blocks there. We do like to talk about productivity hacks on this podcast. Do you have any productivity hacks?
No. I don't know. What are some other things that other people have said?
So people have said...
Like ice baths in the six in the morning?
No. So people have said, the big one is the Pomodoro technique. So work for 25 minutes, take a 5-minute break, do that like 4 consecutive times, and then take a longer break. We've had that one a few times. I've had... another guest said the Bear app. So they use like a timer where like their phone won't work. You actually said one, so time blocking. So a lot of people said time blocking because, yeah, you get caught up in things. And another one I remember, which I thought was really good, if you can do something in 5 minutes, do it there and then.
That's a really good one, and I'm trying to do that more often.
Yeah, because if you don't do it there and then, and it's not like a priority task, it might just get lost forever.
Yeah.
So if you can do it there and then, do it there and then. See, I listened to my guests. Look at that. That was four productivity hacks for free for the price of one. There you go.
I like the 5-minute. I can't say I have a lot of productivity hacks, which I probably should. Yeah. But I don't. I really don't. Like, I'm just being candid.
No.
I'm not super organized. But I will say, no matter how many productivity hacks you have, especially for, I think, like a manager or my position where I need to like oversee how a lot of different departments are doing, it's really important to establish like checks and balances and processes. So be having monthly or quarterly reviews, having very clear agendas about who's supposed to prepare what for those, because even in absence of not being able to put out fire drills or deal with issues all day, you know that like everyone's driving towards the same ship and will have the review on XYZ topic. So it's about like very clearly defining roles and responsibilities and processes across departments for this particular function. Mm-hmm. Because then you can rest assured that the people around you are also going to be delivering and they know what they're doing and we have clear owners. It gets to be so messy when we don't have clear owners on things.
That is, I think that's like such a key insight. And yeah, like regardless of all the day-to-day noise, making sure you have those key checkpoints, it will keep you on the path to success. That's the way I took that. That's amazing. We spoke about like some of the toughest stuff. What would you say is some of the most rewarding things about what you do?
Oh, I love watching people progress in their careers. Like it would be the best days were when you would get to promote someone or like move someone into a new position, even if it wasn't on your team, like getting to just see talent grow and move around. I love watching people win. Like it's just such an electric energy when people are getting a deal across or I don't know, someone has a really good call and everyone's cheering each other on. Like, I'm still very close to the sales and account management teams, but that was like really, it was just a lot of good energy, celebrating a culture of winning. And what else do I like? I mean, I've just learned a lot about SaaS and tech and e-com. And I think especially at this company where we operate in so many different categories internationally, different product lines, like there's so much to learn, but, I don't know. I think it's just been, it's always felt like a different company every year, I guess, for me in particular. But I personally just really like seeing people succeed and win and hit goal and progress in their career. I think that's really what makes everything worth it.
I love it. And I think one of the things I've noticed about people in leadership who I've interviewed on this podcast, they're just all about others and seeing other people win. And you don't notice it having like a one-on-one conversation, but as you have like so many of these conversations, it just fills me with joy because you're just like, oh my god, everybody like sings from the same hymn sheet without knowing it. I mean, I just love having these conversations, man.
Watching good people win. I think it's just, I don't know, it makes me very happy because I've seen bad people win as well. But when good people win, it's just so much better.
We like the good people. But yeah, speaking of like tech in general, to anybody who's looking to get into the tech industry, what would your key piece of advice be for them?
So I think it's really important to understand how big of a company you want to go to. Like tech is a big space. What is it? MarTech? Is it cybersecurity? Like there's so many different potential options. But size of company is definitely important. Like I probably personally wouldn't go to like a 10 person startup, but I don't think I'm actually that risk tolerant. And so I joined Yapa when it was like around 200 people, but yeah, be very familiar with, or know the size of the company and what stage they're at. Understand the competitive landscape. I don't think that's a question that people actually ask very often on interviews, which I'm a bit surprised with, at least for the IC level. And understand like what the growth plan is for 5 years from now. Maybe it's not, we don't know what the growth plan is 10 years from now, but understanding like, is there going to be a stable path in 5 years? Like how are they going to maintain competitive? But I think you get a lot of insight simply by understanding the competitive landscape.
I love that. And you touched on interview there. You've obviously probably interviewed so many people being in management roles, and I'm sure you've done some interviews yourself. What would your key piece of interview advice be? So I love what you just said about understanding the competitive landscape. What else would you say, for the listener?
So competitive landscape to understand how well the company's doing. So if you're going to be like a seller or a CSM, you're going to need to know that information regardless. That's more about choosing which type of company you go to. For me, when I'm looking for people, actually, one tip, always have questions prepared.
Yeah.
If you do not have questions prepared, I just think that's like the biggest red flag. It just doesn't seem like there's any curiosity. There has to be something that you can ask or you've prepared. But just ask, come prepared with questions, like be curious. I find that such a deterrence if people do not.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly because I'm trying to think about their critical thinking skills, and I want to see if they're catching on, if they're asking the right questions, which is arguably more important than saying the right answers.
Is there such a thing as a bad question to ask?
I don't know. Not like a bad question, but if you know it's like canned and it's the same question that maybe they also ask their other interviewer.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. Like, just put some thought into it to show that you're thinking critically.
And I think that's the thing. So yeah. Put some thought into it and try and tailor the questions to like, company.
Or one
the
thing industry. I always test for, and I don't even know if I'm going to tell this interview question because this is my go-to interview question. But one thing I always test for, especially for an IC role, is how well they take feedback. Should I just say the question?
Yeah, say it.
Okay. So what's the last piece of feedback that you received that you disagreed with and why? And then you can kind of tell, they'll kind of think, they'll go to a situation. Usually it's like one of two scenarios where it's either like a scenario that makes them look good or a scenario that's actually honest. And then from there you can tell, how are they thinking about what happened in that? Like, did they blame it on someone else? Did they take accountability for it?
What a question. Oh my God. I'm not thinking now, like, as I'm here. And like you said, if they look too good, red flag.
If they look too good and they're like, I just wanted to work really, really hard and someone yelled at me for, this is a bad, I don't know, I'm making it up. You can tell it's like a fluffy response.
I think, and coming back to what you were saying, right, authenticity, right, as long as you're authentic, it doesn't really matter what you say, as long as you own up to it. Because I think, when people go into interviews, they think that they have to be perfect, they think that they have to be script ready, but it's actually not that, mm-hmm. because a lot of like stuff can be taught.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some intangibles that cannot be taught, and I think it's those intangibles that you have to kind of get out in interviews. Yeah.
I completely agree. Like, some of the core competencies have to be there, but like we've hired from other categories or competitors before, and even if they have transferable skills, like, it doesn't mean that they're necessarily successful. And so I think there's just like some inherent things that you have for each respective type of role that you're in, where it doesn't matter if you know anything about e-com or, ideally you do, but
it gives you
a leg up. But there's some things you can't teach.
I love it. The interview stuff, that's gold. look, if people prepare for that question in any interviews you do moving forward.
I think
they listened, right? You know they did the research.
That's
they've,
good.
They've listened to
I
this.
I've given away my tip. Now I can't ask
this
again.
No. All good. All right, where do I want to go next? So, you're obviously an extremely busy person. My first question is, do you feel like you have a good work-life balance?
No, but it's honestly entirely on me. Like, I could have a good work-life balance, but
It's your decision to work.
It's my decision. Okay. But it's not that I'm like forced to work late. Like, it's just more that I, as a person, like a human, I just can't shut my brain off.
Yeah.
I think I need to get into a better rhythm of working out more regularly and being able to shut off and, you know, spend time with my friends and my family. I don't do a good job of it, to be totally honest, because I feel very invested in work, not because I'm forced to, but because I'm interested in it. But there's times where I'm like, all right, I gotta stop thinking about work now. And it's hard. I actually think what's really hard is that I'm also on like LinkedIn and Twitter, and it's all about work. Yeah. So even when I try to go to social to unplug, I'm still very much surrounded by people that are talking about topics that get my brain going again.
Yeah.
So maybe I need to get that app that you mentioned that just blocks off.
It's a bear app. And actually, talking about LinkedIn and Twitter there, like I've seen, you know, a lot of your posts. They're very good. Well, they're amazing, actually. What's your approach to social media? Are you there reading and learning? Are you there trying to be a thought leader? Can you just talk me through your social media process?
Good question. How often
do you post? We'll start.
I'm very erratic. Okay. It's like it could be two in a day and then one a week. Like, I don't know. Honestly, when I took on the email role, that's when I really started following people, like a lot of thought leaders on email, so I could start understanding the space. I got to give a shout out to Adam Kitchen, agency owner of Magnet Monster. He was actually the one who was like, you should just start posting, like, especially up for Yapo. Like, if there's a lot of like Twitter banter and things going on, and he was actually the one who gave me confidence to just start putting stuff out there. And it was very, very modest at first. I don't have like a rhythm or a schedule. I don't have like, I don't sit down on Sunday and plan out all my posts for the week.
Yeah.
It just comes to me and I just post it. And I mean, if you look at my content, I guess it's largely around like the email product, the Oppo team. On Twitter, I'm a little more funny. Random topics, mostly around this like ecosystem though.
Amazing. And just on that, like you mentioned the fact that, as you've tried to learn more about email, you started following people and being intentional. I've always like tried to do something similar, like follow the right people to get the right information, but sometimes I'm overwhelmed by what I see. So when you're following people, how is it you make sure you're served the right content, I suppose would be my question.
I don't know if it's because I have more people that I'm connected with now, but I feel like LinkedIn is just flooded with thought leadership nowadays. And I'm like, there's a lot of thought leaders, and I don't know if that's just by nature of getting connected to more people. So how do I ensure that I get the right content? You know what? I will say it's not just also about posting things. It's also about engaging with other people. Mm-hmm. So like if someone writes something interesting, I'll comment and I'll have good discussions. But I don't know. I get served up a lot of content, and some of it's good, some of it's bad.
Okay, that's good. I think that's what I wanted to know. It's not just all good, because I feel like for other people.
No, I think it's actually like way too much these days.
Okay, because sometimes I'm looking at people on like LinkedIn and stuff and I'm just like, how are you always on like the comment that I find?
50 ways that you could do. I'm like, oh my God, I just saw this. Like a.
Yeah. But no, this is good to know. I feel like I've heard it from a lot of people, but to people who want to have more of a presence on social media, all they need to do is post, right?
Yeah. And honestly, it wasn't even for me. Like I was actually doing it because I wanted people to understand that we had email.
Yeah.
And it was more of like a, now that I had, or I was in the role, like I felt accountable to drive some awareness that we have this. And honestly, it just kind of picked up steam very organically. Like I wasn't really intending for it to go anywhere, but people actually started to be interested in the posts and the content. And it's a lot just around our product.
Yeah.
So that's honestly why I did it. And now that I've done it for email, and I'm still doing it largely around Yapo, but I think it is, I've realized the power of having a brand, I guess, on social, you know, like even beyond whatever I do after Yapo or later on in my career. Like, I think it's actually quite a cathartic habit for me to write down my thoughts.
100%.
Like once I write it down, I stop thinking about it and then it goes away and then that's it. And it's kind of a nice habit now. I'm not making any money from anything. I'm just doing it because it's nice, but it's made me realize how powerful it is just to start posting, telling stories, and just be brutally authentic. Like the posts that are bad are the ones that are just like clearly not them, you know?
Yeah, I think I agree. I'm just talking about it because I wrestle with it all the time. I'm like, I should, like today I want to post something And I just want to tell more people to start posting.
Yeah.
But I feel like I did one of those like 2 weeks ago. I'm like, every time I feel like I want to post, I'm like, but I said that before. So I just need to change my mindset.
Can I ask you something? It's well, what do you have like your own angle? Because everyone's like, you got to find your niche topic and just focus on that. And I think I talk about email because again, I want to promote Yapo and email, but like, I think you can just say whatever's on your mind. Those posts like work the best.
Okay.
Honestly.
I feel like I should. No,
I think people are scared of backlash or something. And granted, I still, you know, think thoughtfully about what I'm going to help.
Yeah. I feel like a lot of what I want to say is the same thing packaged differently.
Yeah.
And I feel like a lot of what I want to talk about is just like, people are afraid to start things. You should just start.
Yeah.
And I think like that's one of I love to use this podcast as an example, but it's crazy. Sometimes I hate talking about the podcast. Yeah. I'm like, oh my God, people just don't want to hear about the podcast because it's like all I talk about. So I think sometimes I'm just apprehensive, like, oh, he's shoving the podcast. But it's generally like something that I'm passionate about. So
I mean, we joke around internally at the company whenever they're like, oh, Robin's an influencer. Yeah. And it's like it's laughable because like I really wasn't trying to, you know, become an influencer, and that sounds so cringy.
Yeah.
And but it's fun. Like I've met a lot of people through it.
Yeah.
That was the best part about actually starting to post on social. I've just developed these relationships and I finally got to meet a lot of them in person, and it's like amazing.
Yeah.
Like these are people that we're gonna work together, but we're also friends. And
there's a lot of like the upside way outweighs the downside, doesn't it?
Yeah, like I think if people are afraid to post because you're gonna be like that cringy person that does it, but honestly, like the upside of everything that's happened and just being able to connect with more people in the ecosystem, put the email name out there, put my name out there, it's totally worth it. It's a little bit scary,
yeah,
but you're right, people should just do it.
If it was easy, everyone would do it.
Yeah. Well, I guess a lot more people are doing it.
yeah, true. But if it was easy, everyone would continue
doing
it.
But the ones who stand out are truly just the ones that are authentic. Even though more people are doing it, I still know my people out there that I like following that are just very true to their character and just themselves.
Okay, last question on this. Like, I'm sure you have your own style, right, when you're posting. Has your style just come about? Or, like, have you, like, picked from, oh, I like that, so I might use something in that format? Like, how is it you learned your style?
I think I just write how I speak.
Okay.
Or like when I type, like I tend to write in a lot of caps and exclamation points, and I'll throw some emojis in there.
I think that's great. Write how you speak.
Yeah, like I just, it's very informal. I don't follow like a template.
Mm.
But again, I think I'm just I just type it out and I'm like, this is what I'm thinking. And then I'll post it. I do find that like the visuals help a lot. Like if I'm explaining a product release, but for the most part, it just sounds like I speak,
okay.
I think, or that's what I'm told at least.
Yeah. Okay. Amazing.
Yeah.
You mentioned the fact that you don't feel you have a good work-life balance, but in the times you do get to unwind, what do you do to unwind?
Oh God. I watch a lot of TV,
okay.
A lot of reality TV. If I'm feeling, if I really need to veg and I need to just like shut my brain off, I'll just throw on Bravo and I'll watch all the Vanderpump Rules and Beverly Housewives and all that.
Yeah.
Shogun, by the way, is a very good show. Highly recommend.
Yeah, I'm watching that.
Oh,
love
yeah,
it.
Very good.
Anjin, yeah.
What else do I, that's the thing. People are like, what hobbies do you have? And I've realized I don't really have a lot of hobbies. Hang out with my friends.
Yeah, that's.
I need to start exercising again, and then I think maybe that'll be not like a hobby. I'm not a fitness freak or anything, but I don't think I have a lot of other.
Talking about the gym, Third Space. If you want to give sponsorship to this podcast, you know what to do.
You're just asking. Can you see? Third Space.
No, I'm joking. No, Robin, that's great. I think but regardless of whether you have hobbies or not, the thing I love about this podcast is that everyone's different, right? And like, you don't have to have hobbies. You can watch TV. I think what these conversations just show that there's no one uniform thing.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's fine.
Well, actually, when I go on vacation, I really enjoy reading.
Yeah.
But I never really read it otherwise because I feel like I'm too ADD and I can't concentrate. But I actually love reading. So if you have any book recommendations, people, let me know. I like fiction.
We're going to ask you for a book recommendation
very
soon.
Well, I read like trashy fiction. This is also similar to my reality TV show binges. I don't have a good answer for a good book.
Okay. Well,
we'll see
when we get there. Final couple of questions. Where does Robin see herself in the next 5 and 10 years?
Oh, God. Well, I'll get married this September.
Amazing.
I eventually want to start a family. Yeah. Maybe I'll move out to the burbs. Career-wise, I have no idea. Uh-huh. I have never been like a five-year plan person ever. So I don't think I would have expected 5 years ago I would be where I am now. But I don't know. I mean, I'll be at Yapo doing email stuff, and then I've tried to think about what I would do if I left.
Full-time influencer, obviously, clearly.
Full-time influencer.
Brand management.
Yeah. This role has been interesting because I've seen so many different departments now, and I'm kind of like, all right, well, would I want to do that? Like, a couple years ago, I thought I would want to maybe be the VP of sales or something. Mm. Like, I don't know. Now I'm kind of like, do I want to be that? I don't know.
Okay. Watch this space.
So we'll
run it back. When we have millions of listeners and Robin is running the world, we're going to run it back and we're going to see. We're going to play a clip back and be like, look.
This is my first podcast. So maybe I'll become a serial podcast guest.
There you go. We'll take it from there. Robin, this has been such an amazing conversation. We do have a quick fire round, but before we get into it, just like a final takeaway for the listener. If you had like any piece of advice that you wanted to give people who are starting their careers, looking to progress through their careers, what would it be?
Don't assume that everyone knows what you're doing all the time, and don't be afraid to brag. Like, I really truly think that a lot of my progression has not been for me outwardly bragging, but when you do good work, the best people that I've worked with and have been the ones who have seen problems, found solutions. No one told them to find a solution. They did something to help the broader good, built a playbook, fixed a process, whatever it might be, shared a learning. And then when those successes actually work out, like, share that. Those winnings, like, there's, especially at Yapo, like, our company is huge, but at any company you're at, like, you should never be afraid to brag. And actually someone posted about this last week, and I thought it was really resonant. Like, the CEOs don't always know what you're doing and if you're doing good things, so you should never be afraid to like pump yourself up a little bit. You don't have to be, you know, like, super loud and crazy about it, but you shouldn't be afraid to do it either. I think Amazing. It's a great way to bring visibility to yourself.
Robin, thanks. You ready for the quick fire round?
I don't know.
Yeah, you will be. You will be. Here we go. Money or happiness?
Happiness.
Love that. Would you rather focus on maintaining stability and efficiency in current operations or pursue ambitious growth initiatives that carry higher risks?
Obviously the latter.
Okay. Favorite book? I told you I was going to ask you.
I don't know. Okay. I haven't read any good books. They're embarrassingly...
That's fine. Would you rather focus on expanding into new markets and territories or solidify your presence in existing markets through targeted strategies?
Latter. Okay. That's why I'm here.
Would you rather travel to the past or to the future?
Travel to the future.
Okay, nice. Do you have a favorite saying?
No.
Who has it easier, men or women?
Who has it easier? Men.
Yes. And final thing, who would be your dream dinner guest?
Dream dinner guest. I'm trying to think of like a celebrity. Jesus.
Yeah, okay. Jesus it is.
Jesus Christ. Lord Almighty. Yeah, we can just leave that one
okay.
there.
Huh? We're gonna go Jesus. Okay, amazing. Robin, we do have a closing tradition on this podcast. And basically it's knowing everything you know now and with like everything you've been through, what advice would you give your younger self and would you still be doing the same thing?
I would you know what? Like a lot of my periods in my life have felt maybe like hard or everyone goes through their struggles and everything, but I guess I would tell my younger self like everything's gonna be fine. Like it's at the end of the day, whether it's your career or whatever, like there's always gonna be something else for you to do. I think like we tend to think that in our bad moments the world is ending and like we have no other opportunity, but just don't be afraid to take risks. My dad told me a story when I was leaving banking at the time. He was like, all right, I called him and I don't even remember this, but I was like, I'm not happy. And he was like, so do whatever you want. And he tells the story apparently to his students because he's a professor. And so I guess that's my advice. Just don't be, if you're not happy, like, you know, you can change that. And I don't regret a lot of things. I'm very happy with everything I've learned, even all through the trials and tribulations.
Amazing. Robin, this has been such an amazing conversation. Do you want to plug any socials? Where can people find you?
On LinkedIn and Twitter, suppose. Robin Replies on Twitter. Thank you, Joe Talifas, for thinking of that name. And then Robin Lee on LinkedIn.
Amazing. Guys, if you've gotten to this point in the podcast, You know what to do. Make sure to like, subscribe, share, comment. Let us know your thoughts. Let us know who else you want to hear from. This was our first international podcast. Robin smashed it. We loved it. This has been another episode of What My Best Friend Does. If you didn't know, now you know. Over and out.